off the ball. Rugby.
There definitely seemed to be a bit of doom and gloom. You know, with all the stuff around the thing, it's like, well, Sexton's not making the next World Cup, so now we need to start planning without him. So the mind frames and stuff, I don't think it's completely unique the moment we're in. I just think we've a good way of forgetting.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
I'm a very confident front runner for Kelly for 33 years, 145 wins now, and that's the best win I've ever had.
I have no idea what you have.
I don't know. How are we going to count all the shots? I can't keep track.
Fuck! God damn it.
I don't think he's pleased.
Of course you would. That's a particularly stupid question. It's the Irish Open. Of course you want to play at the weekend.
And you're very welcome along to Golf Weekly. It's been quite the week. We've got Anthony Kim with a comeback win for the ages. We have Colin Morikawa, who's back in the winner's circle after what seems like ages, to talk all things golf this week. Joined as always by Gary Murphy. And very, very happy to say, a very, very overdue welcome back to Dave McIntyre. Hey, lads.
Gentlemen, how are we doing?
Very good. How are you, lads?
Very good. Dave, good to hear your voice.
I know, we really are travelling back in time here, aren't we?
We certainly are. I mean, normally I hear your voice commentating on Virgin and the rugby, but it's good to hear you talking golf.
Yeah, it's good to be talking golf again. It's been a long time, too long.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm trying to rekindle my love of this sport.
Oh, really? Had it waned?
It had disappeared.
Okay. Ooh. Why?
Well, my love of the golf course and being out there disappeared really through circumstances. I just realized I could no longer justify dedicating any time to a sport that I was incredibly bad at and didn't derive much joy from, and trying to find 6 hours in a day when you have a couple of young kids and all sorts of other stuff going on, it is just not possible. So I stopped trying to get out there, and the problem is I realized very soon after making that decision that I didn't miss it, and at no point in the last 2 years have I begun to miss it.
Really?
Yes. And not even I might dream about hitting a good golf shot when I'm in a slumber fast asleep in the middle of the night, but I've never really had the desire to try and take the clubs out of the shed, whatever dark, dusty corner of the shed they are in, and get back out onto the golf course. In terms of watching the sport outside of the majors, this schism in the game between the various tours has, it has taken me a while to get my head around it and to feel like I have any desire to sit down on a Sunday evening and watch PGA Tour golf again. Because I do think in the years to come, at some point there will be, this rift will be healed, but you could almost stick an asterisk beside any regular PGA Tour event that has been won in this time.
And look at him laying down a marker early doors. Can I just say, Dave, the last time I played golf with you, which is maybe a couple of years ago or thereabouts, where we played Portmarnock Links together, I have to say, I thoroughly enjoyed our time together. It was...
Well, I thoroughly enjoyed my time with you. And if you want to go meet for coffee and spend some time together, mano a mano, Fiona, I'm happy to do it. But I'll even go for a walk over the front nine for you if you want, but I'm not going to be carrying any clubs.
Gary Murphy, how on earth did he manage to solve the problem of golf addiction and we haven't?
I'm curious why this weather is not inspiring him to get out there and play. But
it's hard to get out when there's no golf courses open.
Is the K Club's closed, I'm assuming, is it?
Yeah, it's been, I was just saying to Dave off air there, yeah, we've been open probably, I don't know, 3 or 4 times since January.
Yeah. Same with us in Killeen Castle, it's just...
I think the big thing from, it's just the damage can be done when you go out there, and I think for all golf, like I've, you know, we've all had videos on WhatsApp, I saw Hermitage
the other day. Did you see Hermitage? Jump. Like a lake?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mad stuff. And it's like a lot of course, especially the inland courses, you know, they're kind of dangerous. You know, if you've any courses with hills and humps and bumps here and there, and you're, you know, a lot of membership is, you know, of the elderly variety, so it's not good. But then, you know, let's hope we can get a decent spring and some kind of a summer and make up for lost time. Because a lot of the time, this time of year, you know, the golf is placing everywhere and it's it's a lot of muck anyway, but hopefully it gives people an itch when the weather...
We'll talk about the placing of Pebble Beach on Sunday in a moment, but so obviously I'm in Killeen Castle, and so I put my name down every week, so no golf really to speak of since January, like you, Gary, and then last Saturday. Now, I was a bit forlorn now because I figured we were expecting crappy weather, and on Friday night, I got 40 millimetres of rain, and the photographs that went around the next morning, it was like the 17th was unrecognisable. The water had come in. It was horrendous.
I have a strong opinion on this because I think the game is so difficult as it is. Now, it's a phenomenal advantage to be able to place a ball, especially in wet conditions. But a mud ball is, you know, it's unplayable.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's incredibly unfair. We played, I was playing somewhere and I'd hit a good drive and it just went on a corner, went just into the rough and was covered in mud. And there was a hazard both sides and I literally had no shot. And I thought, well, it's only a bit of a fun game, so I'll try. And it was only a 7-iron, kind of punching it. It wasn't that hard a shot. And it just went like at right angles into the hazard. So I think, and it's hard to call it as well. You know, there's a bit of experience in it, but it's a guessing game. So I think placing at times is a necessary evil.
Oh, no, for sure. I mean, look, I mean, we winter rules and all the rest.
But I do think a mud ball, I think it should be able to, you should be able to clean a mud ball and drop it.
I mean, I couldn't agree more, and that's what I think. That's a rule that is long overdue. Anyway, look, we'll talk more about the. We're going to start, and we don't often start with a LIV event, but we're going to start with LIV this week. So, Anthony Kim won the Houston Open in 2010. Okay, Dave, that's probably you and I. We were regulars on Golf Weekly back in 2010, and Anthony Kim was being spoken about as the next generation of great talent, absolutely remarkable golfer, and then because of very difficult personal circumstances, addiction, alcoholism, and took 12 years, like disappeared, never to be seen again, or so we thought, and then reappears last year. They bring him on to LIV, and dare I say, very few people were very kind about his appearance. He looked like he'd been through like a car crash. He looked like he'd worn each of the last 12 years like very, very heavily. And, you know, his early forays in LIV were disaster, came last, ended up losing his card. And then this year, through that weird qualifying system that LIV has, got his card back, was he 5 back of John Rahm and Bryson DeChambeau? Now, this is John Rahm, who chips in for eagle on the Saturday evening to tie Bryson at the top. And it looked like this is going to be a straight kind of heavyweight fight between two of the best golfers in the world. And by lunchtime on Sunday, Anthony Kim is a winner. One of the greatest comebacks you've ever seen, or not?
Yeah, it'll be very easy to exaggerate these circumstances, but it's up there with the great sporting comebacks, certainly in golfing history, but maybe more broadly in sporting history. Because, as you say, when you look at Anthony Kim, when he came back onto the scene there 18 months ago, there was a real sense that this was a gimmick, and LIV were desperate for some credibility, for some legitimacy, for some presence outside of the LIV Tour itself, that people might have their interest peaked, because nostalgia is a very powerful tool, and we would remember Anthony Kim at Valhalla in 2008 and the swashbuckling style which he played the game, and the fist pumping and the brilliant putter and the desire and the willingness to take on pretty much any shot, how he devoured Sergio Garcia for breakfast on the Sunday singles under Paul Azinger in Valhalla. That is 18 years ago now. And it was around the time where Tiger was starting to really start to experience the problems that obviously dogged his career all the way through to his next major title victory, which wouldn't be for another 11 years. And there was a vacuum there. There was a vacancy for a huge name and a massive personality. And everybody was looking at Anthony Kim and thinking, this is going to be the guy. He's young. He's of mixed race. He's got a different background to other guys. He's vocal. There doesn't seem to be any reputational respect from him towards some of his elders. He was exactly what the game needed, and then he vanished after that win in Texas in 2010. He vanished, and he almost became a mythical character. Where is Anthony Kim? Rumors of sightings of Anthony Kim, a potential talk of maybe a documentary around Anthony Kim, and the outside world had absolutely no idea of the torment that he was going through, and we still don't really. We've only got the headline stuff from it, but as you say, when you look into his at him on camera and you look into his eyes, you can see how drawn his features are, the years of substance abuse are, the stories told on his face and on his body. He has been through the ringer emotionally and physically. And you can definitely legitimately compare this to Ben Hogan in 1950 winning the US Open after nearly being smashed by a Greyhound bus and coming back to win a major championship when his body was literally broken, to Tiger Woods coming back to win a major championship 11 years later and all the issues that he had physically, emotionally, on and off the golf course. This is up there with anything that we've ever seen. And for the way that he did it, and I think it was fitting that it was a LIV golf event in Australia. Yeah. Because maybe only Scotland and Ireland can rival the sense and the feel that an Australian crowd bring to a professional golfing event. They're similar to what you might see at the Scottish Open or the Irish Open or a Ryder Cup on Irish soil. They come in huge numbers. There's a real respect and appreciation for the players. Honestly, LIV Golf should play there every week. We see it with the Australian PGA Championship, the Australian Masters at the back end of the year. And if they had those sorts of crowds and noise at every event, there wouldn't be so much of talk of buyer's remorse and guys looking to return to the PGA Tour. And then the way he played, as you said, Fionn, like he was 56 of 57 LIV players in year one. 55 of 61 last year, had to go back to their equivalent of Q School. And the first time he's found himself in and around the winner's circle in the guts of a decade and a half. And how comfortable did he look?
Yeah,
his putting was astonishing. So many one putts. I think he played the last seven holes in 5 under par. He literally couldn't miss. Like the hole must have seemed like it was 6 foot wide for him. And then the fist pumping starts to come again. He starts to get the crowd on his side. And there's real echoes of 2008 Anthony Kim when he was at his very best. Mm. And then to see his wife and his young daughter joining him on the green and his daughter in his arms as he went up onto that very unique LIV Golf stage to pop the champagne and absolutely magical.
Come here, listen, you're gonna say you get bring tears to my eyes. Gary, I mean, there's lots of little side stories to this. He shot a bogey free 63. Like, in fairness, both I saw Rahm, but also Bryson gave him a big hug at the end, and that was like, what did he say? That was fucking incredible or something to that effect. But you could see they were incredibly generous in losing to Kim. Now, of course, there's an interesting irony. Had the event just been 54 holes, he wouldn't have won, you know, or maybe he would have. I don't know. Maybe he would have primed himself differently, but we'll never know. Like for you, like what did you think of? How did Kim look?
Well, obviously, he looks poor.
Sorry, I don't mean like physically, but his game is like his general golf. He just played like amazing.
I think the scary thing about it is that. His golf looked like it used to look when he was in his pomp.
Yeah.
You know, and you've got that gap of, 12, 13 years, and he probably didn't hold a golf club for, I don't know.
12 of them.
One of them, maybe. 12 of them.
Yeah.
And I've never been a big fan of Anthony Kim's. I met him in a casino one night in Korea. We were playing an event there. And like he was big time, you know, he's in the casino, he's got the big chain around his neck and, you know, he was a dude, you know, and he had a big stash in front of him and that was his persona. And obviously he's fallen, you know, an enormous fall from grace. And the great thing about it was he kind of ate into the moment really and created the moment. Nowadays we've so many faceless kids on tour and, you know, they're coached within an inch of their life and they show no personality. And he, you know, as Dave was saying, like the Aussie crowd are amazing to play in front of. You know, it's some of my most enjoyable experiences have been down there because they kind of get it and they can create what the American audience try to create. So there's a great buzz. There's great fun from the crowd, but also there's huge intimidation.
Yeah.
And a lot of kids nowadays are taught to, you know, stay in the present and don't respond. And he just kind of put the whole crowd up on the shoulders and carried them in on the back nine. And to start fist pumping as early as he did and maintain it. And then his interview afterwards was, you know, it was really raw and honest. And he's always been an amazing player. You know, he'd, I think, 11 birdies around Augusta National. So he's always had that X factor. But to lose it and to, and as you were saying, you know, to take down, obviously DeChambeau was out early doors, but to take on Rahm in front of that crowd and just own the moment. And, you know, it's a story of redemption, really, and he can only be inspired by it. And hopefully he can continue and kind of get, you know, I think the playing pitch is kind of going to level out a little bit going forward. So, you know, I don't know, are there going to be special exemptions if he continues this form?
Yeah, well, he's jumped from
all these major.
He's gone from 847th in the world to 203rd. So, you know, that's...
I loved his line, Fionn, where he was talking about his daughter and he said, look, she's probably too young to understand exactly what's going on now, but in a few years' time, when she does have an appreciation for what happened today, she might think that her maybe after all, her dad isn't a loser.
Yeah,
that was a man.
That was quite raw to hear, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Just... He doesn't, nothing is kept under the surface. Like he's owning or desperately trying to own. And I don't have any sort of a background in addiction or recovery or that kind of thing, but I'm sure it's something that you carry around with you all of the time. And he looks like he's willing to speak about it. Not the detail, but the scars that it's left on him emotionally and physically, that he is, he's just something so different. And my God, it's exactly what Liv needed.
Yeah, he reminds me, he obviously reminds me a bit of John Daly insofar as like great talent undone by years of you know, abusing, you know, John, I'm assuming it's a lot of booze. But unlike Daly, who really seems comfortable in his persona, like of the, you know, the rebel who never played by anybody else's rules and seems happy enough to be like crystal meth Santa, you know, Anthony Kim came across as someone who has gone through an enormously difficult and painful time and now wears the scars of it and knows that the path out of it is through being honest, through talking. You know, you described it, Gary, as quite raw. It is very raw. And like, just like, he looks like someone who's been to like the world's longest party and didn't enjoy the second half of it.
Yeah. And I guess the thing is, like, there's a bit of, you kind of go fair play. Like, it's hard enough to get away for a night or two, but he got 12 years out of it. So, but the way he has put himself back out there, because, you know, when he started back out on Liv, you're playing against, you know, realistically the best 50 odd players in a professional sport. And he at that stage is probably ranked, you know, 5,000 or 6,000 in the world.
Yeah.
Realistically speaking. So to have the courage, and he got in Mark Greg Norman too, to kind of go, you know, there's a story in this. They would have sat down and obviously had many parameters for him, you know, to stay within in order to give him that chance. And plus, there's always been this question mark over, you know, the insurance and financially. And there's no doubt financially he must have been in a tough spot. You know, you go on a bender for 12 years, you're going to rinse through whatever you've made.
Yeah.
Realistically so. But to have the courage to get back out there and...
Is it the courage or the need? Like, what else?
You still... Well, obviously there's a need, but to put yourself back in the spotlight like he did, and you know, there were a couple of green shoots, but he lost his status, and then to go back and get it and open up the way he did from, like, the previous week in rehab was like playing in a mortuary. So embrace that atmosphere in Adelaide and come through.
Well, in fairness, like, rehab is more, we got to, you know, you got to play where the paymasters are, but Adelaide's an entirely different thing. Let's talk about, like, obviously we know what this means for Anthony Kim. It's also worth pointing out, he nearly didn't get there because he didn't realize he needed his visa, got sorted right at the end. So he almost was excluded for not getting his Australian visa. So you mentioned it, Dave. So in commentary, so Jerry Foltz and Dave Faraday were, you know, they suggested that this was the equivalent of Ben Hogan in 1950. And in terms of like the stark nature of it, I wouldn't disagree. But like, it's worth pointing out that Ben Hogan then went to win four majors and never finished outside the top 10 of any major he teed it up in between 1950 and 1959. Ben Hogan is one of the greatest golfers of all time. Anthony Kim, with all respect, isn't. But that notwithstanding, this is a remarkable story. It's a remarkable story that only becomes remarkable when you have Anthony Kim winning or playing very, very well. So to what extent do you think this is really, as good as it is for Anthony Kim, how good is it for Liv?
Well, he had to win for it to be a story.
Yeah.
I think if Anthony Kim misses one of those final two putts and he finishes runner-up or third, we're probably not even... we're saying, oh, it's not great for Anthony Kim. Yeah. He's played some good golf, but we're certainly not giving it the attention that we currently are. I'm not sure we're in a position just now to answer that question as to what it means long-term for Liv. I know when you were kind of sending us through today's talking points, you mentioned something about, does this bring legitimacy to Liv?
Yeah, that, I guess it's that Liv needs human stories for people to feel a connection to it, you know? And I think this is a very human story. Like all my golf friends, straight away, like on the WhatsApp groups, it's like, this is amazing, this is incredible. And they're not, these aren't men that are given over to kind of, you know, oddly sentimental bursts. Like these are, you know, guys who like, it takes a lot to get them round. And to a man, everybody was taken in by this Anthony Kim story.
Okay, and once you know the background to Anthony Kim, and any golf fans who are more of just than the casual variety, they will understand where he was 18 years ago. They would have watched Ryder Cups and major championships. But the next question is for your golf mates that you're referencing there. Does what happened in Adelaide at the weekend make you in any way more likely to watch the next LIV Golf event?
I'm going to say yes. Well, also the fact that, sorry, to which I add, the fact that it's on TNT, the fact that I can watch it now more readily than I could before. Not that I couldn't, I don't know. But the fact that it's on TNT, the answer is yes. I want to see Anthony Kim teeing it up at the next one, for sure. Gary?
I'm not sure I'd be bothered watching Anthony Kim tee it up at the next one. Like, even if he wins the next one, nothing can rival what happened.
No,
I don't know where their next golf event is. I don't know where LIV Golf are going next. But I've no interest in watching Rahm and DeChambeau duel it out at the top of the leaderboard in a LIV Golf event. The music in the background just grinds my gears in a way that I never thought possible. I can't watch a golf event where there's constant music being pumped out.
It's not that loud in real life. It's more on the broadcast, I think, than actually.
Maybe they should dumb it down a bit in the broadcast.
Well, I think it was a little gimmicky, and you know, if they're going 72 holes, I think the Aussie team story was a great story as well. You know, winning at home and
that added to it
too. So,
and we got to see that Cam Smith was actually still alive.
Now, I have to say, I'm LIV agnostic. I will watch LIV. I like some of the golfers a lot, including Cam Smith. The team aspect of it just has never fired my imagination. I'm a traditionalist. I like individual stroke play or match play, whatever. But like for me, I want to see. I don't care about any of the teams. I don't care about the Four Aces or the Three Amigos or whatever the hell, you know.
Yeah, I think the narrative all the time is that, you know, we're watching these sports people and they're doing what they're doing, and you know, the, you know, I want to be at home and spend time with family and all that sort of stuff. And we're trying to turn these people into, you know, Buddhas, basically. But Kim's story, he's actually genuinely used his family as that tool to get him out of the mire that he was in.
Yeah.
And it's his focus going forward. Whereas 90% of the time, you know, it's a load of rubbish. It's just a throwaway line. So there was a bit of realness to it. I don't know, it's the whole, you know, and I don't really buy into the comeback story and compare it to Ben Hogan. I think it's not even in the same ballpark. You know, you have a choice to do certain things in life, and you choose to do them more often than not. Ben Hogan did not choose to get mangled by a truck. And I think comparing that to an Anthony Kim comeback story is, it's not in the same ballpark.
I take your point, Gary, but you could also make the argument that in active addiction, you don't choose that, you know, the thing is more powerful than you. I'm sorry, I'm nitpicking here, but I know the point you're making. But ultimately, regardless of the why of the thing, the what of it is that Anthony Kim, his comeback is as unlikely, given what he's been through, as Ben Hogan's was, given what he went through.
It was, but I've always had an abhorrence with, you know, watching elite level sport, and somehow, you know, we can enjoy it and learn from it and marvel in the ability of the sports people doing their thing. But can we not just enjoy it for what that is? Why does it always have to, you know, this amazing courage, and, you know, it always somehow has to filter into every, why does it always have to filter into everyday life? And the commentary, I didn't enjoy the commentary coming down the stretch in that regard. I was so excited. I watched it live. I was so excited watching him do his thing, and it was amazing. And it's a unique story that we haven't really heard in recent times in the sport of golf. And just take it for what it is. It's stunning, and his ability to get back to the level that he's gotten back to, that's the real excitement factor. Mm. I just hate when the narrative all the time is, you know, he's going to go off to somewhere and save a farm. You know, I don't know. I don't like that part. You know?
Dave, as someone who obviously, you know, makes
you
a career.
You commentate all the time, Dave. Yeah. What do you think on that?
As a commentator, is that like, how do you resist, or how do you walk that line between giving it the kind of the air it deserves and not over. This is such a terrible metaphor. No, you know what I mean? How do you walk that line between, like, you want to capture a moment, you want to represent a moment, but at the same time, you have to kind of connect it to, like, the here and now, the real thing?
Well, I suppose golf commentary is a little bit different, because those guys in the commentary box for LIV, or indeed whatever the tournament might happen to be on whatever tour, you've got several hours for the story to unfold.
Yeah.
And you can build the enormity or otherwise of what's happening in front of your eyes over a period of time. When I'm in a commentary box, if something extraordinary happens, it is usually in the moment. And whatever words pass your lips are totally unscripted and totally unplanned. So though David Fogarty and his pals there, they would have had the best part of a 90 minutes, 2 hours, to kind of get a real sense as to how they felt about this, where it ranked in the great sporting comebacks. And you could make an argument that they've over-egged the pudding a little bit, but it is an extraordinary turnaround for a man who was on his knees. Like, we've no real idea of the turmoil that this guy has gone through. When Ben Hogan went through what he did, he was one of the great golfers in the world at the time. And it was a question of, and similar to Tiger Woods with all the injuries and the back surgeries and the knee surgeries, will he be able to get his body back in a position to swing the club so that he can do what he does best? And in a lot of ways, Anthony Kim's comeback story is far more unlikely.
Yeah.
Because
totally. When you're at the bottom of a bottle or at the end of a line, and this has been going on for years, and your body has been rotten from the inside out, and everything you've ever dreamt of having has dwindled away, you probably can't look at yourself in the mirror. I'm sure the levels of self-loathing are just beyond our comprehension. To find yourself in the position that he has over this last week must be unfathomable. Where I would imagine Ben Hogan, look, this is all speculation. We're talking about a man who did what he did like 80 years ago or so. I would say Ben Hogan was in his hospital bed and he was looking around at people going, you mark my words, this is not going to beat me. Mm. I'm going to get back from this. I'm going to get onto the golf course. I'm going to prove everybody wrong. And I'm going to go out there and I'm going to win another major championship. And all the naysayers and all the people thought, oh, this old man is broken now and that's the last we'll see of him. Well, I'm going to show them. I'd be surprised if Anthony Kim ever thought that.
Mm. No, I think that's all. That's all. Absolutely. I mean, look. In fairness, like, the poor lad shows up, like, you know, not looking unlike Daniela Westbrook. You know. So
yeah.
Right. Anyway, look, well done, Anthony Kim. Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. I can only hope for his sake that, like, you know, whether he wins again or not is immaterial to me. But, like, I hope that he just continues to perform at a level rather than just kind of have a moment and then kind of disappear again. Because, you know, I like the story. I think it's a good story. Equally, right, let's move on. Colin Markawa.
Let's move on to another extraordinary comeback story.
It kind of is. Like, I mean, two majors, like, again, promise. This is a guy who's going to dominate. He's going to be a great player. Hasn't won since 2022. And just, you know, putting woes. Just can't seem to be getting the ball into the hole. And given, like, what was a pretty decent field, maybe some, obviously, Scheffler was there, Shane Lowry, sneaky good, coming up the outside. Rory never really threatened, was fine, but Scheffler just, and to have Morikawa just come out of the field and comfortably just put it away, I thought was, well, it's great for the AT&T, it's great for Colin Morikawa. Gary Murphy, are you impressed?
I am. I'm a huge fan of Morikawa's. I just think he, you know, physically plays the game extremely well. He's always going to have issues on the greens. I just don't think he's naturally a confident guy on the greens. He's so unbelievably efficient in everything else that he does. Yeah. And it was a big win. Like, it's a huge, you know, you look at, obviously, the course was a stick up for these guys. You know, 6,900 yards, there's no wind as such. There was a bit on Sunday, but the ball is basically stopping where it lands, so it's target golf. And that's probably a tougher environment for him to win on, because you're going to have to hold some putts doing that.
Yeah.
This is always a fascination for me. A guy, a 36-hole lead, let's say he's 10 or 12 under after two rounds, can he improve on that? You know, can he, if he's 10 under, can he shoot 21 under? And he was unbelievable. You know, he's 7 under through two rounds, not really at it as such. And he shoots 15 under for the last two rounds. So, yeah. You know, he's won two majors. He looked like he could be a next level player when he did that. And this is a big shot in the arm and a big start to his season. He's put a bit of speed on too, which is important. He was a little bit short for elite level, and he looks like he's put on about 4 or 5 miles an hour, so, which is huge at that level. He's one of the good guys out there. He's someone that you can cheer for too. And he beat his kind of best buddy Minwoo Lee down the stretch, so that'll give him a little bit of bragging rights. And he beat the kind of unbeatable Scotty Scheffler, so that's also a big shot in the arm for him. He's able to win majors. We predicted, or I predicted on this a few years ago when he won a second, that he might win about 6 or 7, so he's a long way to go from that, but it's a big, big win for him.
Dave, I'm just looking at some of the stats here. 22 or 28 fairways over the course of the windy weekend, 60 or 72 greens in reg over the four rounds. He was 44th in strokes gained putting, so 115 putts, only 251 feet made. So good putting, not like absolutely banger, but it was more approach. Like, he just made every green in regulation. He was like metronomic getting onto the green. Hasn't won in, as I said, 847 days since his last win.
Yeah, October 23 at the Zozo, I think, was his last win.
Yeah, which all
and this, you couldn't
Zozo,
say this was coming. This was no way was this flagged. Like, his 2026 start has not been good. Like, he missed the cut in Hawaii at the Sony. I think he was tied in mid 50s or so in Phoenix. So no one was having him down as a potential winner before he headed to California this weekend. But he said, particularly after his 62 on Saturday, he said his irons reminded him of his old self. And he's a streaky enough putter, probably a confidence putter, not dissimilar to McIlroy. Gary kind of hit the nail on the head there. The last few seasons haven't been easy for him. Like, he really struggled on the greens. He went down a few rabbit holes looking to find his swing again, as so many pros who've scaled the heights and then have struggled to retain that status do. And he went through several caddies. So I suppose you're thinking, well, I haven't changed that, so I'm going to have a go at looking at an alternative there. See, does that trigger some level of improvement? And I have to admire the way he held himself on the last, because the group in front of him obviously were hitting the self-destruct button. I think it was a 29 minutes he was standing over his second shot.
Yeah.
Like, imagine in a penalty shootout with a major tournament on the line. Yeah. Having to stand over the penalty spot with the ball in your hand. We saw Troy Parrott had to spend 3 or 4 minutes with the ball in his hand in Budapest there a few months ago. To do what he did and hit the green, fat at the green, leave himself 20-odd feet for eagle, knowing that he needed a four to win, that's pretty impressive as well. Mm-hmm. He'll take an awful lot from that also.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, I have to say, just to that, he was waiting because Jacob Bridgman went onto the beach and then tried to take one off the beach, hit the cliffs and sayonara into the Pacific. Took a drop, but it took forever. Like, you know, went back, took a drop. Like, Gary, it's one of the best sixes I've ever seen.
It was, and it's kind of... I was surprised he didn't try drop it the first time, to be honest.
Rather than take it off the beach?
Yeah.
Really?
I mean, it's such a dangerous shot. You know, he's a good player, but it's a big week. He's having a big finish. I thought the caddy should have been stronger there, going, let's just drop this and try to get up and down for par. The worst we're making is six, and it's kind of stress-free. I just thought it was a bit of an inexperience on both our parts, because you're thinking, oh, I'll get this up and down and make four. But that's that moment where you need the caddy to do the thinking for you. And then he did remarkably well to finish the way he did, because, you know, as Dave was saying, the length of time and everything. I think if he were to do that again, he would have, you know, dropped it and just try and make a five that way. But for Morikawa to be sat there and put the swing on it that he did, and it's good solid two-putt. You know, we've seen
off the fringe as well.
A lot of, but you know, those Poana greens are not easy. We saw Rory miss some very short putts that you don't normally see week in, week out in the PGA Tour. So he'll take a huge amount from that. It was a big win.
It was,
and he's in California too, which is nice as well
at home. So you mentioned like a 20 was a 23 under. That was the that's what he won.
Yeah.
Like, they're taking Pebble apart, you know, and I appreciate it, but like, paradoxically, watching it on TV, the conditions look really more difficult than you would expect. I realize it's February in Monterey, where it can be as cold as anything, but like, there was a bit of wind, it was cold. Like, at one point, it looked like, are they playing in the Arctic? You know, they were all so bundled up. But like, is the course just not... I don't mean fit for purpose in the sense of, like, are the players just dominating the course now, no matter what they do to it? Or does the course rely on the wind to blow hard to protect itself against these guys?
I think it does. And I think the wind direction helped enormously for the scoring too. It was pretty much down breeze on the back nine. Like, we haven't really seen guys going into 14 with irons, or like Scheffler was only hitting 6 iron into the last. You know, so just the direction of the wind, I think if it had been the other way, the scoring wouldn't have been as low. But 6,900 yards is just so short for these pros nowadays.
Yeah.
You know, even like the Irish Open last year in the K Club on a very soft course, but it was what, 7-3 and a bit of change. It was probably playing 7-5, 7-6.
Right.
And they still, you know, then Mother Nature has to be... The only leveler is firm greens. That's the big thing, and a bit of wind. But firm, fast, breezy conditions are really the only things that will keep scoring down.
I mean, that notwithstanding, the work that CBS, who were the main broadcaster, did, they had drones, they had, like, you know, kind of a slightly more developed version of Shot Tracer, it seemed. But, like, the coastal holes, I you know, the coastal holes still look amazing, don't they, Dave?
They do. You can always hang your hat on that. Whatever about the status of the golf course as a true test for the modern day professionals. Some of the shots are unrivaled, really, on any other golf course in the States in particular. Like, the scenery is just incredible. Yeah. The views never grow old. I know that Bernard has been going there since the 1940s. But what, in terms of what happens on the course, like, the vast, vast majority of our Pebble Beach memories are, for the most part, US Open related. And seeing it play so easily over the first 3 days in particular, and then with preferred lies on the final day, and the green speeds were dampened because of the weather conditions, it does dilute it as a golf course and as an event. Like, remember watching McDowell win his US Open there. He was even par for the 4 days. What a test of his stamina and grit that was. It was a true US Open test. Even Gary Woodland, when he won it there, was 13 under par.
Tiger Woods was the only player under par when he won.
Yeah, and he won. He was 12 under. It was ridiculous.
Yeah.
I don't know when the US Open is going back to Pebble
next
again.
Year.
But next year, right. So we don't have long to kind of to compare it to what we saw in the weekend just gone. It'll still be spectacular, but they will need the wind to blow and they will need the greens to be firm and fast.
Yeah.
You'd wonder, Phil, why they don't try play this tournament at a different time of year.
So I was literally going to ask you that exact same thing. Is that, like, I mean, but surely you'd expect in February. Like, I don't know, have you been to that kind of San Francisco area? Well, it's just south of San Francisco.
No, never. No.
It's fucking Baltic at this time of year.
Yeah.
Like, it can be really cold.
But even, let's say, the US Open's there next June.
Yeah.
This is a signature event.
Yeah.
You're playing for 20 million bucks.
Yeah.
You know, why not have played that event in June this year? You know, something like that. Because you want to see them burn a little bit playing for 20 million bucks, whereas if it's just a shootout, I don't know. It's obviously, it's all...
Well, it's part of the Western swing, isn't it, Gary?
Yeah,
they started in Hawaii. They're obviously going to Riviera next week.
It would mess the whole schedule up.
Yeah. I know, but it makes a mockery of the test if, you know, on such an iconic golf course, if you're shooting 12, 13 under for the week and you don't even get the television, you know what I mean?
So before, I want to ask you about, actually, let's do it now. Let's talk about preferred lies. So, like, and I saw lots of people complaining they had preferred lies on Sunday. They were expecting weather. That weather really never came. Now, Gary, my understanding would be that the organisers have little choice. If the early starters are not getting the weather and they're going to be playing, like, the course in relatively benign conditions, but they're anticipating, like, heavy weather to come, say, for the second half of the starters.
Yeah.
It penalises the second half unnecessarily with the potential for mud balls and all kinds of, like, horrible things. So is the decision to just go with preferred lies from the start of play really just to protect or to level out the entire field?
I'll tell you, it's just protection, 100%.
That's it. So yeah, it's not like...
Element.
Yeah.
It's an element of fairness. And
why doesn't that happen at an Open Championship then, Gary? Where the early starters on a Sunday, for example, I know Friday, Thursday and Friday is more draw related, but on Saturday and Sunday, if the early starters are going out in what you know will be the best of the weather and that there's a storm coming in the afternoon, why are they not taking similar moves, steps to protect the field in those circumstances?
But you're not going to get plug because lies at the Open, are you?
You'll never get a mud ball on Lynx Golf in July. Yeah.
No, but you could end up with a situation where the weather has obviously decided the event.
Sure, but...
Not placing wouldn't have an issue, wouldn't make... If it's blown, you know, it's flat calm in the morning and it's blown four clubs in the afternoon, you're probably not going to be hitting any fairways anyway, so it's not going to make much of a difference. But no, it's more mud balls. That's what it's for. Because Augusta don't do it. You know, they never place at Augusta.
No.
And there's been a couple of years where it's just been ridiculous. But their theory is we're never going to do it.
Yeah. I mean, can we talk a little bit about Scottie Scheffler? So, like, again, so now this is his 18th top 10 in a row. I think it's his 8th or 9th top 5 in a row. I think Tiger has 11 in a row, so he's a ways to go before he beats that record. But 2 weeks in a row now, Scotty starts indifferently. Like, really just looks like he's just nowhere until the weekend. Then come the weekend, just starts putting on the afterburners, and before you know it, like he actually led. Now, it was unlikely he was going to stay leading. He knew it himself in the interview. He needed probably two more, but like, just the metronomic genius of this player is surely just, ugh. Like, how many times do we need to find words to describe his play?
It's phenomenal, really. I think, and what you're probably looking at, if you look at, you know, an Anthony Kim conversation, or Tiger Woods with his off-course stuff, he doesn't seem at the moment from the outside looking in that he's going to have any major distractions going forward off the course. His desire to perform is very powerful at the moment, and it doesn't seem like there's any possibility that's going to diminish in the near future.
Mm.
So if he opens up with a 63 on a Thursday, we'll be all looking at Glenn Rowan on Sunday night. You won't even bother watching it. So it's spectacular, really.
Is it spectacular, though?
Well, no, it's not, but if you're just looking at his achievement and the way he plays the game, you know, it's Lionel Messi stuff, really.
Yeah, it's fabulous. You know, it's remarkable. Consistency and an unbelievable level of skill. He is.
But why don't we fully appreciate that? That's
the conundrum. He lacks charisma.
Because it's not spectacular.
Yeah, he doesn't have.
There's nothing spectacular about it. He's that good.
It's golf is spectacular.
Is it though? To you, it might be, Gary. You're a professional. You appreciate to a far greater degree what he's doing with the club in his hands and how he's manipulating his golf ball and his ability to get his yardages spot on all of the time and to get the ball in the right areas almost all of the time. And for me, that's what makes it unspectacular. And it's why he doesn't get the same level of appreciation outside of the 15 majors that Tigers will always get so much credit for. But Tiger put himself in some really awful spots over the year. And he had this mercurial, remarkable level of skill and talent that when he was forced into a position where he had to produce something special, he was capable of doing it. Scheffler doesn't put himself into those situations often enough for it to be spectacular. And I don't want to discredit him in any way. I'm starting to appreciate what he's doing with some of these mid to long irons in particular. I see those shots now, and he hit a few of them on the Sunday. Three eagles he had on Sunday. I'm thinking, that is amazing.
It's incredible. But it's incredible.
Does he ever have me on the edge of my seat? Do I ever think, oh, I don't know what this lad's going to do next? Like
Rory McIlroy.
I was just going to, you took the words out of my mouth. The eagle he made on 15 at Augusta on Sunday.
Yeah.
That's spectacular. That is... Vomit all over yourself. Extraordinary.
Lads.
And Scotty Scheffler is one of the all-time great golfers, and I think he's going to win like 8-9 majors. He's going to be up there with Watson and Faldo and these boys. He never has me screaming in, you know, wonder at the television.
I want to finish up here. We're just conscious of time. So I want to say Shane Lowry, sneaky good, okay? So he finished tied 8th. 5 under on Sunday, just really kind of solid without being, to use that word, spectacular. But like, again, if he's not an elite level golfer, he's certainly just the tier slightly below that, but not much below. Now, Rory McIlroy, okay, final round 64, finished tied 14th. Okay, and you're like, for a player of his caliber, whatever. He made 2 eagles, 20 birdies, again, very good. But he also made 4 double bogeys or higher. Like, is that just Rory doing Rory things?
Yeah, I think so. That's you know, it's funny with Rory. You can kind of feel when it's his week and when it's not his week.
Yeah.
And that's why we love him too, because when he's on, he's probably the polar opposite to Scheffler, really. But if he can turn up, you know, at Augusta or Birkdale or wherever they're going this year with an A game, he can take on Scheffler. But like, Scotty Scheffler will never ever win a Masters like Rory won it. So I kind of get that point too. Yeah. But yeah, I think it was a little off. I'd like to see him have a good week this week.
Yeah.
He's, and Shane too. Shane doesn't have much of a track record around here. So,
no.
But I think, yeah, Rory was just a little bit off it. And it was kind of a Rory week, and he's still threw in. I'm fascinated by his ability and his professionalism to you know, with all that he has, that he still goes out and this backdoor top 10 or backdoor big finish, I think it's a great level of professionalism more than anything, really.
Gary, what do you think's driving him this year?
Oh, yeah.
I think five is a lot when you have four, and it's not a lot when you want six. That has to be, the Faldo thing has to be, you know, the greatest European. Seve had five, Faldo's got six.
Faldo was never chasing the slam, though. There was never that one moment where it felt like the weight of the world had been lifted from his shoulders and he'd scaled the ultimate height.
Yeah, I do. But when they were commenting on the players and maybe being a fifth major, and he said seven sounds a lot better than five. So if it was to be a major, which obviously it never will be. But yeah, I think, yeah, majors have to be. And then, you know, I think the order of merit thing, if he gets to seven majors and he gets past Monty, he's the greatest European ever, which, you know,
he probably is.
I'm not saying that he's not, but, you know, it's like the Jack and Tiger argument. You know, Jack is more than Tiger, so in theory he's the greatest. So I think that's his fuel going forward.
Lads, time's against us, so we're going to have to leave it go. Before we do, I just wanted to pay credit to Mary Meeker, who became the first female winner of the Pro-Am at Pebble Beach in its 80-year history. So congratulations, Mary. She partnered Keegan Bradley. They beat Akshay Bhatia and Ruben Richards. Anyway, there you go. Well done, Mary. Nice. I'd like to play in that Pro-Am. So if anybody's listening can make that happen. Just
I think Bhatia had the trousers on hot wash all week, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. Good old... Actually, yeah, Bhatia just felt like he just kind of... He was there and then he just kind of fell away and it's very kind of... Ugh. Yeah.
Are you a fan of those trousers just above the ankle?
Yeah, they don't bother me. For a guy like... No. I mean, what is he? 6 foot and he weighs like 4.5 stone. Like, you know what I mean? anyway... Yeah.
Thanks, guys.
Listen, Gary, as always, thank you very much. Dave, brilliant. Thank you so much. Great to have you.
Really enjoyed that, lads. Thanks, man.
And look, Ryan Lyon coming at you on Thursday with Nathan. So if you have a question, you can put it into the Discord channel or you can email golfweekly@offtheball.com. That's it from us. We'll talk to you next week.
Right here in Dardanelle, all picket now. Little J.D. Starter.